again, we're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
I like to think of Occupy in some ways as a fire bell in the night. It's a warning to this country. It's a warning of how bad things are now and how much worse they could get if Occupy is not successful.
Coming up, we'll hear from a member of Occupy Chicago talking about the breathtaking growth of that movement in its initial months.
But I did not reopen the wound. The wound never healed. And it cannot heal.
And we'll hear from scholar and activist Norman Finkelstein speaking at DePaul University nearly 4 years after his famous tenure fight there. But first, here are some headlines from the indie media movement in Chicago and around the world with Mitchell Schweinchick.
Poland indie media featured the massive growth of protests against ACTA, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. ACTA is an international treaty that would allow copyright holders the right to take down entire websites that carry any copyrighted content in any country that's a signatory to ACTA. One feature on Poland Indie Media listed protests in 14 cities in Poland, organized through Indie Media and Facebook, held during the days of January 24th through the 26th, 2012. The protests appeared to have made a difference. In early February, Polish Prime Minister Daniel Tusk, who stated his public support for ACTA, announced Poland's suspension of the ratification of ACTA. And since Poland is a member of the European Union, if ACTA fails in Poland, it might well fail across the entire European Union. Indie Media UK followed recent developments on behalf of workers struggling against an international pizza franchise for, quote, a larger slice, unquote, quoting from one feature. On February 4th, 2012, Sheffield Pizza Hut Workers Union, part of the Industrial Workers of the World, held a protest outside Pizza Hut in Crooks, Sheffield, over their ongoing dispute over workers' terms and conditions. Solidarity protests were held across Britain, as well as in North America and Europe. The dispute centers on several specific aspects: pay for working on bank holidays, mileage rates, and recognition of the union. Also, the Pizza Hut Workers Union has concerns outside of this dispute, including delivery staff's safety gear, a decreasing pay package that falls behind inflation, and a demand for a real living wage for all Pizza Hut workers. The worldwide indie media movement has continued its coverage of the Occupy Wall Street movement, some of whose stories include the following. Indie Media UK has been following the progress of students at the University of Birmingham, fighting in February 2012 against an injunction obtained by the university which bans all occupational protest for 12 months. Austin Indie Media featured the results of a leak discovered by the internet group Anonymous, suggesting that the private intelligence firm named Stratfor has been working with Texas law enforcement to infiltrate Occupy efforts in Texas. IndieMedia.us featured developments in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, San Diego, and Portland, Oregon, opposing the influence of big money in politics, highlighting protests timed to January 20, 2012, the second anniversary of the infamous Citizens United ruling at the Supreme Court, eliminating corporate limits on political elections. Atlanta Indie Media identified an Atlanta police officer and Homeland Security agent, James Hodge, who has recorded recent Occupy Atlanta events. Rochester Indie Media posted a video showing two members of Occupy Rochester woken up by Rochester police at the Occupy Rochester encampment on February 2, 2012 at 2 a.m. Hours later, the New York Civil Liberties Union released a statement demanding that Rochester police stop their illegal harassment. L.A. Indie Media featured a student protest at the University of California, Riverside, disrupting a regents meeting, seeing police attack protesters, arresting three. And D.C. Indie Media reported on efforts by Occupy D.C. and other groups on February 20th, 2012, a day of action against the prison system and the new Jim Crow, as it's called. The Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center featured efforts on the week of February 7th, 2012, by community members united in opposition against expanding the Champaign County Jail. This marks the second consecutive week to oppose such plans, and ran the gamut of reasons voiced during public comment. Among them, Rebecca Ginsburg, a University of Illinois professor, pointed out the failures of the criminal justice system, citing the 51% recidivism rate in Illinois. Mikhail Lyubyansky, who writes and teaches about restorative justice, said, "Jail is just one strategy, not the only one, to public safety," and called on the county board to look into alternatives to incarceration. Not one member from the public came to give their support for the plans for a new county jail. Chicago in the media featured the resolution to a 9-year-old lawsuit over a major anti-war protest. Quoting from the feature, attorneys representing some 700 arrestees and detainees in the famed March 20, 2003 anti-war protest on Chicago's Lakeshore Drive announced that they have won a multi-million dollar settlement with the city of Chicago over the illegal crackdown of that protest by the Chicago police that night. The city has agreed to compensate all arrestees and detainees a total of $6.2 million. Some of those arrested and charged may receive up to $15,000 in compensation. The settlement represents not only a financial win for protesters and members of the public, but the intermediate rulings in the case affirm the right of public protesters amidst open police crackdowns, a development expected to help activists planning to protest the NATO G8 summits in Chicago in May 2012. And Chicago Indie Media has, for the first time in 7 years, moved its website to a new software platform. On January 28, 2012, Chicago Indie Media's main website began using the Drupal Content Management System. More information is online at chicago.indiemedia.org and at drupal.org. Drupal is spelled D-R-U-P-A-L.
Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Leave these people alone. They're U.S. citizens. U.S. citizens. U.S. citizens. U.S. It does not make you want to do this to them. It doesn't. Stop hurting these people, man. Why y'all do this to our people?
Don't let these cowards deceive you and be the next mouse in the talons of an eagle. Discuss these wealth gap is an unbalanced as evil. We celebrate access while the people have less and poverty, abject madness. While the economy collapses, ass stress, that's the last straw. You want class, well, we'll give you what you ask for. The have not that the have, so we came to crash your party and we ain't leaving until we even. The Constitution guarantees these freedoms. Anyone against that committing treason, you're not a real patriot unless you stand for what you believe in. And nobody got more welfare than Wall Street. Hundreds of billions after operating falsely, and nobody went to prison. That's where you lost me. But my home, my job, and my life is what it cost me.
Occupy Wall Street has gone through a considerable number of changes since its initial emergence in September 2011, and many of the Occupy efforts in larger cities have faced public attack by police and authorities. Nevertheless, Occupy struggles on, involved in many cities with housing, reclamation efforts, foreclosure relief efforts, anti-poverty efforts, and challenges against corporate power and corporate influence. We'll hear about Occupy Wall Street and local Occupy Chicago efforts from Bob Simpson, an active member of Occupy Chicago and a longtime political activist who spoke about Occupy Chicago and the Occupy movement at the Third Unitarian Church of Chicago on November 13, 2011. Bob Simpson is carrying a Guy Fawkes mask, commonly seen at a lot of Occupy protests.
We're going to do something called a mic check, and I'll explain what that is in a moment. What it is you repeat after me the words mic check when I say it. Mic check!
Mic check!
Good enough. Okay, don't repeat this part. This came about because in Liberty Plaza up in New York, Mayor Bloomberg did not allow them to use sound equipment, which is obviously a problem, and you have a crowd of several thousand people or even several hundred people. So they invented this thing called mic check, where the people in the front would repeat in unison what was being said so the people in the back could actually hear them. So let's practice a little bit of mic check here. Mic check.
Mic check.
What does labor want?
What does labor want?
We want more schoolhouses and less jails.
We want more schoolhouses and less jails.
More books and less arsenals.
More books and less arsenals.
More learning and less vice.
More learning
More justice and less revenge.
More justice and less revenge.
In fact. More of the opportunities to cultivate our better natures.
More of the opportunities to cultivate our better natures.
A quote from Samuel Gompers. President of the American Federation of Labor, 1915. All right. Hey, y'all are good. Now, I'm going to take out my glasses because I need to see what I'm doing here. Okay, Sam Gompers wrote those words in the year 1915 because he understood that the labor movement is a civilizing force in the United States of America. The Occupy movement is also, in its own way, a labor movement. It's very different than the one that Samuel Gompers was involved with way back in 1915, but it has the same civilizing function. It's working class people demanding to be treated with dignity and respect. It's the greed and the brutality of our present economic system has become intolerable to many Americans as it undermines our living standards and democracy itself. The lives of our young people have been filled with uncertainty and dread. Young people feel left out of our political system and they are yearning for a voice. The Occupy movement strives to be ultra-democratic and give a voice to those who have been excluded. That's why Mic Check is so powerful. It literally gives a voice to people while encouraging them to listen to what is actually being said. It's also a very slow way to run a meeting, which is a downside, to be sure. But the Occupy movement is new, and it's trying to give that voice to the voiceless, those who don't have the luxury of owning a powerful TV network or expensive lobbyists. It's trying to open up a national discussion about the economic and the social crisis which is gripping this country. So people pitch tents in public parks. They march on banks and other institutions. They sit down on the street and they submit to mass arrests, as has happened here in Chicago. My court date is tomorrow. Many of us are asking that our arrests be quashed on First Amendment and free speech grounds. I know, fat chance, but you got to do what you can. Chicago has had 350 arrests so far, I think, maybe more. So, why this Guy Fawkes mask? You'll see that a lot at Occupy demonstrations if you go to those. It's from a film about an anarchist revolution against a future fascist government called V for Vendetta. Some of you may have seen it. The main character wears the mask. It's a favorite thing at Occupy supporters, among Occupy movement supporters. In the movie, the main character speaks about the importance of words and of speaking out. When he makes a pirate broadcast to a nation that is living under fascist rule. Quote, this is from V, the character. There are, of course, those who do not want us to speak. I suspect even now orders are being shouted into telephones, and men with guns will soon be on their way. Why? Because while the truncheon may be used in lieu of conversation, words will always retain their power. Words offer the means to meaning, and for those who will listen, the enunciation of truth. And the truth is, there is something terribly wrong in this country, isn't there? Cruelty, injustice, intolerance, and oppression. And where you once had the freedom to object, to think, and to speak as you saw fit, you now have censors and systems of surveillance coercing your conformity and soliciting your submission. How did this happen? Who's to blame? Well, certainly there are those more responsible than others, and they will be held accountable. But again, truth be told, if you're looking for the guilty, you need only look into a mirror. I know why you submitted. I know why you did it. You were afraid. Who wouldn't be? War, terror, disease. There were a myriad of problems which conspired to corrupt your reason and rob you of your common sense. Fear got the better of you. Well, this film was a fantasy, but the country that V describes sounds an awful lot like the USA in the wake of the September 11th, 2001 attacks, when as a nation we succumbed to fear and blundered into a war and cruel attacks on our immigrant population. This was a world where a lot of the young people who make up the spearhead of Occupy grew up in, a world where fear seemed to rule for a time. Now, there was an awakening in 2008 around the Barack Obama campaign, but many of the young people who poured their hearts into it have been disappointed in the results. There's a lot of youthful energy that drives the Occupy movement and a lot of distrust of leaders, authority, and hierarchy. I think disappointment with the Obama presidency is part of the reason for that. Occupy confronts a global social and economic crisis, and it is now a global movement. You have to keep that in mind. There were Occupy events in 951 cities in 82 countries in October alone.
Say that again.
951 cities in 82 countries. That's just for the month of October. I've seen statistics in November that actually push it up some. Now, Chicago itself is a global center of finance, capital, and international trade. We are a global city. So what does our global city look like to the people who work with Occupy Chicago? Well, when I walk along State Street in the Chicago Loop, I see the gravely wounded from America's class war lining the sidewalks. You see them begging for chump change, styrofoam cups in their hands, hoping they're going to find a place to lay their head at night without getting them bashed in by some knucklehead out there. A civilized society would never tolerate this kind of neglect. Now, if I cross the bridge over the Chicago River on Michigan Avenue and walk north by those glittering consumer palaces of the Miracle Mile, I can see those gorgeous outfits that just scream money and power. Now, much of the labor that goes into them comes from third world sweatshops where the working conditions would gag a maggot. Now, these objects of splendor may scream money and power, but they can't even whisper the word civilization. Sweatshops would not exist in a civilized world, period. Frankly, I think like most of you, I'd love to live in a civilized country, in a civilized world. But truth be told, we're not even there yet, not even close. Now, some of us live in places that have the trappings of civilization, things like modern plumbing, government, houses, taxes, libraries, schools. But don't be fooled. A democratic global civilization is more than just some of us having those modern conveniences and being able to visit an art gallery. It's about all of us having access to those things. And in this world today, that simply does not exist. Folks, I think it's time to raise the bar on what the word civilized really means. If you want to live in a civilized society, it takes a labor movement. Now, today we have the Occupy movement. It is committed to nonviolent change and so far has stayed pretty close to that ideal. Not perfectly, but I'd say pretty close. At its heart, it's a working class uprising that is rejuvenating the traditional labor movement as it forges a path of its own. America's unions were quick to recognize this, that a new labor movement was rising up, and have joined it. It's been officially endorsed by Rick Trumka, AFL-CIO president, and union members have taken part in Occupy demonstrations in large numbers. I'd like to thank our union brothers and sisters for donating things like tents and food and basic supplies, printing facilities. They've been wonderful. Occupy Wall Street, though, is just one of many of the labor revolts we've had historically here in this country. And hopefully Occupy will take us closer to a goal of a civilized America because it is in a fine old American tradition. Let's take the American Revolution, for example. People gathered in taverns and public squares. Public squares. Keep that word in mind. This early working class dove into Tom Paine's pamphlets. They discovered political philosophy And they discovered that they were indeed smart enough to rule themselves. Goodbye to kings and queens, lords and ladies, and the whole sorry lot. Brains and ability don't necessarily travel down the inbred bloodlines of a people weighed down by powdered wigs. A genuine civilization demanded much more than that. The first labor unions demanded more than just better wages and working conditions. They demanded public schools and public libraries. How could anyone have a decent family life and enjoy any kind of cultural or intellectual activities without some time to do that and some education? The abolitionist movement was a labor movement. Can you think of labor being more viciously exploited than it was under slavery? I can. So when Jubilee came and slavery was finally abolished, it was one of the first things that slaves demanded. Teachers. Teachers and books. The more, the better. Because the freed slaves wanted to do their part in bringing a democratic civilization to this nation which so desperately needed it. The workplace sit-downs and strikes of the Great Depression paved the way for the GI Bill so that working-class veterans could obtain an education and a modest home. Things which today seem like an impossible dream to so many people. And I come from one of those families, and I am so grateful to those people in the 30s that did that thing so that I could have a decent life. When Dr. King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, it was at the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, initiated by A. Philip Randolph, president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, president of the Negro American Labor Council, and vice president of the AFL-CIO. This was also a labor movement, a movement to open up equal opportunities, to end the terrible racial divisions that were tearing this country apart, and to unshackle people's minds from the mental chains left behind by racism and oppression. So a labor movement is so much more than just wages, jobs, and work rules. A labor movement is freeing working class minds so that people may achieve their authentic human potential. This is why I think the Occupy movement is in that tradition that goes back to the time before the American Revolution. It's a step in the right direction, as previous steps were. Now today, just look around at our evolution deniers, our climate change deniers, our racism deniers, our gender equality deniers, our labor haters, our war makers, and our surreal TV reality shows, and ask yourself, why are so many minds chained to this kind of folly? And who benefits from this kind of willful and militant ignorance? It's a good thing I'm not a conspiracy theorist, or I start thinking that the 1% wants it this way. They want to keep us trained enough to turn a profit for a global multinational corporation, but not smart enough to ask why. Why does society put so many obstacles in front of people trying to educate themselves? When I was in jail with those young students, I couldn't believe it. Going to college today is so totally different than when I went to school, and I was last in school only in the 1980s. It's all turned around now. We know that poverty is the single greatest obstacle to education. So why does our society make poverty even worse? Why is the 1%, their percentage of the amount of wealth they control, gone beyond off the charts? And you can look up the stats for yourself. Why does our society demand a new indentured servitude of student debt for our college students? It doesn't make a damn bit of sense to me. What it sounds like is society actually trying to limit the talent pool of smart and creative people to the affluent and the well-born. Certainly looks that way to me. I thought we had an American Revolution to deep six that kind of so-called thinking. Now, the Occupy movement has spread very quickly, and it surprised not only the banksters on Wall Street, but to the small group of anarchists who actually started it. Yes, they were anarchists. And anarchism definitely has its influence in the Occupy movement. But today it draws support from a very wide range of people, from plumbers who keep our toilets flushing, and that is definitely part of civilization, to the art students who passionately want to reshape our culture as media workers. And I was in my jailmate was a art student, film student from Columbia. If they just let that man loose, we're going to have a culture you're not going to believe. This guy was really good. So if you're serious about civilization, you know that plumbers, farm workers, factory workers, janitors, bus drivers, office workers, nurses, teachers, and bridge inspectors are all vital to that. If you go down to LaSalle and Jackson on a busy day, you'll get beeps from bus drivers, cabbies, and everyone else if you hold up one of those Occupy Chicago signs. We get a lot of support from the working class here. So why are these people's wages and work being so devalued? Their wages are being cut. Their health care costs are skyrocketing. Their homes are being foreclosed while they are being subjected to indignities, both great and small, just for trying to do their job. If you're serious about civilization, you must know that literature requires writers. Music requires musicians. Theater and dance requires actors and dancers. The visual arts require visual artists. Has anyone else besides me noticed how they're cutting our arts and music programs across the country? Or that students who are trying to attend colleges to learn the craft of the arts are being priced out of existence? If people can no longer get the education, the time, or the monetary support to create art, then the arts are going to wither. What about scientists and engineers who bring us these miracles that we love to play with all day long? They need an education, not just in their specialized fields, but in the ethics and morality of how their work is used. The more that a university education becomes an impossible obstacle or a distant dream, then science and technology will suffer. The more universities are starved for funds, then the more science and technology and engineering shrivels. Is this any way to build a genuine democratic civilization as opposed to a mockery of one? It's things like this that drove the young people to start and be the core of the Occupy movement. This is the kind of thing that they see. So enduring the terrible weather at times, the awful media coverage, at least in the beginning, the mass arrests, rubber bullets, and tear gas, the Occupy movement seeks to fix our broken economy through national discussion and national civil disobedience in a way that this nation has not seen in generations. And at what a speed, thanks to the internet. This is a labor movement carrying out its civilizing mission in our best traditions. And it has gone global, which is necessary in our faster-than-light-speed globalized economy. The New York Police Department penned in three peaceful young women demonstrators on a public sidewalk and deliberately maced them in the face. It went out all over YouTube and all over the world. That made a difference. Videos of hundreds of people being arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge, including many who thought the police had actually directed them to go that way, also went out on YouTube around the world. That made a big difference, and it actually grew the movement as opposed to suppressing it. When a young Iraq war veteran was shot in the face standing in front of a police line in Oakland, California, the videos of that outrage sparked the closest thing to a citywide general strike that we've seen since 1946, the year before I was born. You see, I got some gray hair up here. It would be a mistake to think that the Occupy movement can be reduced down to a set of bullet points or demands that their enemies can chew over. It's an exploration of possibilities and the creation of the new. Any scientist will tell you that a lot of experiments are going to fail, but they provide you with the path to get you to the right direction. It's a movement of the young apprentices who gathered on the streets of Boston and Philadelphia before the American Revolution would recognize the Occupy movement kids immediately. They're the same people, just 200 some odd years later. But this is the 21st century, and we do have a whole new set of challenges. The Occupy movement uses consensus as opposed to majority rule at their general assemblies. You actually have to be there to take part in the decision making. Now, many of us have pressing work, academic, and family responsibilities, so that tends to exclude those people. The Occupy movement is very suspicious of establishing clear public leadership. This has its advantages when your movement is new and you don't really know anybody and people have not been tested yet. And this movement is less than 3 months old. Leaders can also be burnt out, bought off, and knocked off. But sooner or later, a movement does have to spawn an organization and some kind of accountable public leadership, or it's going to die out, at least in my opinion. So people are asking, where do we go from here? There are encampments in some of the smaller cities and towns that get along with the local governments very well. But in larger cities where you have serious corporate power like Chicago, Boston, and New York, there have been mass arrests and police violence. That means that a lot of people's energy has to be put into defense as opposed to working on the social issues that we came there for. And that's a problem. People are discussing that. There have been problems in some of the camps. There's a lot of people out there in America who are very damaged, and they don't function well. They don't function well in a packed environment. And how do you deal with that? There have been incidents where women have felt unsafe. How do you deal with that? How do you get through the winter time? What about cities of Chicago, like Chicago, which after 300 arrests has no encampment? Occupy Chicago is as homeless as some of its activists. Also, the Occupy movement is politically independent. From here on in, I will judge all political parties, whether they're Democratic, Green Party, Communist, Socialist, I don't care, by how much they respect that independence. Because it has to stay independent of partisan politics, no matter what they are. Finally, the Occupy movement is still overwhelmingly white. I want you to imagine if Occupy was mostly people of color and only had minority white participation. Does anybody seriously think the police behavior would be the same? That the demands would be the same? I wager everything would look very, very different. There's been a lot of discussion about this among activists, particularly activists of color. There is now a movement called Occupy the Hood, which basically attempts to deal with those issues right in people's own neighborhoods. And we had a demonstration about 2 weeks ago right up here in Austin about a foreclosure. And I think this raises another critical issue, and I'm going to wrap this up. Every time this country has had a multiracial, genuinely multiracial, working class kind of movement, it has met with the most ferocious repression. Just think what happened to Reconstruction after the Civil War, or our Civil Rights Movement. Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party was assassinated very close to where we are today because he succeeded in beginning to build a multiracial movement of revolutionary youth. What's going to happen if Occupy does become a genuinely multiracial movement? I don't know, but I think people have begun to question what that is. I like to think of Occupy in some ways as a fire bell in the night. It's a warning to this country. It's a warning of how bad things are now and how much worse they could get if Occupy is not successful. So I have a special warning to Wall Street. You may not like the disruptive, nonviolent demonstrations that you've had so far. But you know, if you don't listen to them, the kind of protests that could come after them, you will like even less. Americans are not a patient people. We don't all have Gandhi in our hearts. So in closing, I'd like to quote from Eugene Victor Debs, a labor leader of another time, but whose words seem to echo through the decades. Quote, 10,000 times has the labor movement stumbled and bruised itself. We have been enjoined by the courts, assaulted by thugs, charged by the militia, traduced by the press, frowned upon by public opinion, deceived by politicians. But notwithstanding all this and all of these, labor today is still the most vital and potential power this planet has ever known. And its historic mission is as certain of ultimate realization as is the setting of the sun unquote, we are the 99%.
That was Bob Simpson speaking at the Third Unitarian Church of Chicago on November 13th, 2011. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Excuse me. Every single member of my family on both sides was exterminated. And it's precisely and exactly because of the lessons my parents taught me and my two siblings that I will not be silent when Israel commits its crimes against the Palestinians.
Norman Finkelstein. He's a professor of political science. He's been at the center of numerous heated academic and political disputes.
You know how often I speak, I never get demonstrations.
My life as a Jewish person, my life as a American, every facet was out of step.
There is no new anti-Semitism. This is pure fabrication.
Norman is a very careful scholar. He feels very passionately about the Holocaust.
Norman Finkelstein was a scholar and activist, a PhD in politics from Princeton, and a noted professor who taught political science, focusing in particular on Israel-Palestine and on politics of the Holocaust. Most recently, he taught for 6 years at Chicago's DePaul University and was up for tenure in 2007. Finkelstein received majority committee votes recommending tenure. After a subsequent public debate, the DePaul board assigning tenure, which many say was influenced by outsiders, voted 4-3 to reject tenure for Finkelstein, despite his contributions to teaching and scholarship. Finkelstein was placed on academic leave and ultimately resigned from DePaul after agreeing to a settlement with the university on undisclosed terms. Norman Finkelstein gave a public lecture at DePaul University on January 16, 2012, the first time he lectured at DePaul since his resignation.
This is actually the first time I have stepped foot on DePaul in the 4 years since I left in early September. And it did seem to me that would be appropriate when coming here to speak about the events that climaxed in my tenure denial. Just as a preliminary remark, I have invited all the principals involved in my case. I have invited them all to attend this evening, and I have promised them that they would have the full right of reply to express their opinion. And then, as John Stuart Mill put it in On Liberty, the combatants come out under their colors, and then the public decides or tries to figure out where is the truth. I'm not sure if any of these persons I invited are here now, but I wanted to make clear that the invitation was extended. The subject of this lecture is my tenure denial. And the proposition that I should speak on it evoked a lot of reaction, not only among those who would prefer I not speak on it because of what I have to say, but even among those who I count as my friends and my colleagues. Some people have asked, why am I reopening the wound? After all, fully 4 years have now elapsed. Shouldn't I move on already? But I did not reopen the wound. The wound never healed, and it cannot heal. I cannot move on. DePaul destroyed my professional calling. There's nowhere to move. But some people have asked, didn't you sign an agreement, a settlement agreement? I did. But my remarks tonight are unrelated to that agreement. But some people have asked, why drag the pool through the mud again? But I am not dragging the pool through the mud again. The pool is dragging itself through the mud again. I made a reasonable proposal beginning this past summer to the Paul's administration and board of directors. If you acknowledge your wrongdoing in my case, if you apologize for the wrongdoing, and grant me the tenure that I earned and that I deserve, then I would consider the matter closed. I pointed out to the Paul administration that a precedent was set for this action last year when Father Holtschneider reversed his decision to deny a professor in the chemistry department tenure. But the Paul's administration and board of directors said no. Some people have asked, why drag the Paul faculty through the mud again? But they are dragging themselves through the mud again. I offered each of the faculty and administrators implicated in my tenure case an option. If you publicly acknowledge wrongdoing, apologize for the wrongdoing, and call for my case to be reopened, I will not mention your name in my lecture. Each and all of them refused. I might also ask, I want you to ask yourselves, as I've asked myself the past 4 years, is it right that not one DePaul administrator or faculty who participated in the plot, and yes, it was a plot to destroy my professional career, not one suffered any formal penalty or censure? Is that fair? Is that right? In fact, many of those who destroyed my career subsequently and coincidentally received promotions. But it still might be legitimately asked, even if everything I say is true, and to the best of my knowledge, it is true, should I sink to their level? Won't I be debasing myself and the larger political cause on which I just spoke? And I must admit that this question, it gave me pause. I had to wrestle hard with it the past few days. Should I lower myself to the Judas in my department, whom I befriended and who then stabbed me in the back purely and simply because his ego could not bear my stealing a bolt of his thunder? The voice inside me, it said, no, Norm, don't go there. so I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the chair of my department, who ranked me the worst teacher in the department, although I had among the highest, if not the highest, student evaluations? Should I lower myself to this chair who declared a new book of mine published by the University of California Press and endorsed by six of the leading experts in the field? He declared the book was worthless, although he hadn't read a single page of it. Should I lower myself to this chair who, unbeknownst to me, had entered into a secret correspondence with Alan Dershowitz and then conspired, yes, conspired with him to stop me from getting tenure? The voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the five senior members of my department who said I should not be allowed to return for the last year of my contract because, in the words of the chair, I might commit a Virginia Tech? The voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the dean who inflicted a salary cut on me after I was promoted to a tenure-track job? It's not every day. In fact, it was the first time in all of DePaul's history that someone got a job promotion and a salary reduction. And he then launched a personal jihad to deny me tenure. The voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the dean who recommended against tenuring me after the tenure committee voted unanimously to grant me tenure, and then whispered to faculty that he had, quote, secret information on me? I told my former co-author, an expert on war crimes, about this whispering campaign. She responded aghast, "Holy cacao, it sounds like a KGB operation." The voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the DePaul administrator who accused me of violent assault and of promoting, quote, bestiality, incest, and rape in my classes? Should I lower myself to this administrator who repeatedly lied about her knowledge of my tenure case, who refused to recuse herself from the hearing, who refused to let me bring a witness, any witness, to the hearing, and who dismissed my offer to take a polygraph, a lie detector test, to prove my innocence? Should I lower myself to this administrator and the provost who abruptly dropped all the charges against me when I threatened to go public with this filthy frame-up? But the voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the DePaul Law School Dean, who contacted Alan Dershowitz, who, according to Dershowitz, launched his own investigation of me, and who stated that the evidence supporting Dershowitz's allegations against me were overwhelming, although he never bothered to contact me and hear my side. But the voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the two DePaul Law School professors who told the law school faculty that I was a Holocaust denier, that I was part of the Iranian-Venezuelan worldwide conspiracy to deny the Holocaust? But the voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the law school professor on the University Board for Promotion and Tenure, who insinuated that I did not have a residence in Chicago? This was a quite novel suggestion. It was common knowledge that I arrived in my office every day, 7 days a week, at 9 a.m. and I stayed in my office until 1 a.m. So I must have been shuttling back and forth from New York, day in and day out, in the middle of the night on a private jet. But the voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the psychology professor on the university board who wondered aloud why I carried on like a victim, and whether I suffered from a victim complex? Really, where could I have come up with the preposterous, the absurd idea, after that last blissful year at the pool, that I was a victim? But the voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. Should I lower myself to the DePaul administrator, who after a lucrative career as a Holocaust huckster, was hired by DePaul, and in a conversation with a distinguished professor at the University of Chicago, after the settlement agreement had been signed, and in flagrant breach of it, he said to the University of Chicago professor, "But you don't understand, John. We have secret information on him." But the voice inside me said, "No, Norm, don't go there." So I won't say more. In fact, I dare not say any more. Didn't DePaul deny me tenure because, unlike my accusers, I don't practice Vincentian values? So I will stop here. I don't want to disappoint my students in the audience who stood by me during the most awful experience of my life. I say it in all sincerity, were it not for my students, I probably would not have endured that wretched year. Thank you. I don't want to disappoint the three tenured faculty, Sumi Chow, Gil Gott, and Azza Layton, the three tenured faculty, and the three junior faculty who support me in thick and thin, and to whom I am eternally grateful. Thank you. And most of all, I don't want to besmirch the cause and the principles that have animated my adult life by dwelling on the Lilliputians who destroyed my teaching career. I recently started reading through Gandhi's collected works, as I mentioned earlier, and I learned a lot. One of the things I liked most about Gandhi was that he was acutely aware of his flaws as a human being. He used to say that he had 1,000 faults. And I don't think he was exaggerating. And I don't think he was saying it for rhetorical effect. He knew himself, and everyone who knows himself or herself knows you have many flaws. But the knowledge of his failings did not stop Gandhi from doing his best to make the world a better place. No one is more acutely aware of my flaws than I am. I bear that burden every minute of every day. If the hairs in my head are now few in number and white in color, it's not because of heredity, and it's not because of the attacks on my person. It's because of my own inner struggles and my own self-doubts. I don't like to be put on a pedestal because I am so aware of my flaws. I do not want to pretend that I never did anything wrong or never did anything that I was subsequently ashamed of. But DePaul's plot to deny me tenure had nothing whatever to do with my faults. In fact, and ironically, it viciously attacked me and destroyed my career because of my virtues, which although few in number, they still found threatening.
That was Norman Finkelstein speaking at DePaul University on January 16th, 2012. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. To learn more and get involved in making media, including making this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Rita Sand and to the DePaul University Chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine for audio assistance. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode from the Trenches.